The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Jonathan Reckford, Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for Humanity International, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
I would imagine that most everyone listening knows of at least one person who has volunteered to help build a simple, decent, and affordable house as part of Habitat for Humanity, the largest nonprofit builder in the world. There's an awful lot that goes into this, not just in the United States, but in the nearly 70 countries where they operate. And here to walk us through it all is Jonathan Reckford, the Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for Humanity International. Good evening, Jonathan, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thanks for having me on your show.
Why don't we begin by having you give us some of the history of the organization, which might be useful since almost everyone I know thinks that Habitat was founded by President and Mrs. Carter.
You know, Denver, it's so true. I think that the two things people know most about Habitat turn out not to be true. One, that President and Mrs. Carter founded Habitat, which is not true, though we can certainly talk about how they put it on the map. And that the second is that we give away houses, which is also a misconception. But Habitat was actually started. The backstory is a quite remarkable pastor named Clarence Jordan in 1942 started an interracial farm in southwest Georgia. And you can imagine how popular that was in southwest Georgia in 1942. Mm-hmm. And so the farm always struggled. They were boycotted, bombed, harassed. But he had an extraordinary influence on a large number of pastors and social leaders and was a great believer in nonviolent social justice. And he, in the 60s, gathered a group together. The farm was really struggling to think about what might be next. And out of that time of prayer and deliberation came this idea of a fund for humanity, where they would surround sharecropping farmers who were living in these terrible shacks, build them a proper house, and then give them a no-profit loan that they would then pay back, and then actually in the spirit of community, keep making payments after they'd paid it back so that the fund would be sustainable and their repayments would help the next family have the opportunity to have a loan. Hmm. And our founder, Millard Fuller, was part of that group and part of that original test group, and he then took the idea to Africa, what was then Zaire, and tested it for 3 years and came back in 1976 and officially started Habitat for Humanity, and really spread as a grassroots movement. He was very charismatic, and if you sat on a plane with Millard, by the time you got off the plane, you'd start Habitat wherever you were. And so it just really bloomed across the world. And then a pivotal moment really was in 1984 when President and Mrs. Carter got involved. Mm-hmm. And I actually just did the checking. I think cumulatively between 76 and 84, we had built 758 houses across the world. And you can really see the inflection point. After the Carters got involved, Habitat got a huge amount of attention, and their continued presence and so many people getting involved and taking leadership, we've now been able to help over 13 million people worldwide have new or improved housing. So it has it's been exciting to see. But the basic idea and core principle has held all the way along. Clarence had a wonderful quote. He said, "What the poor need is not charity but capital, mm-hmm. not caseworkers but co-workers. And what the rich need is a wise, honorable, and just way of divesting themselves of their overabundance." And he had this view that everyone had something to give and everyone had something to gain by working together. And that spirit of Habitat has always been that way. So volunteers come, we do subsidize the loans to make them affordable, but there's always been an element of both sweat equity, the families actually help build their homes and their neighborhood homes, and then they pay back that affordable mortgage, and we recycle those payments in the same community, helping the next family have an opportunity to improve their living conditions. And then we also do view part of our mission is to influence the volunteers and build community. And we've seen transformation both in the lives of volunteers and in the families who are purchasing the homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, housing is often overlooked when poverty is discussed. But the ripple effects of having a stable home, whether it be for the members of the family or the community itself, they really can't be overstated, Jonathan. What are some of its impacts?
You know, housing is, as you say, so fundamental. It really is foundational for all the other things we care about. And I'm always similarly surprised that it's not higher on the priority list. What we really see in the data is overwhelming is the direct correlation that if a child grows up without proper housing, she doesn't stay healthy, she doesn't do as well at school, and therefore has a very low chance of being self-sufficient. If you inject good housing in, it doesn't solve everything, but we see much better health outcomes, therefore better educational outcomes, therefore the better chance of being self-sustaining economically at the end of the cycle. And we've seen over and over again families breaking that intergenerational cycle of poverty. So we really do think housing is a foundation. My growing hypothesis, Denver, about why it hasn't been higher on the list is in our increasingly economically segregated societies around the world, most of us can live our daily lives without seeing the way that our brothers and sisters in other parts of our same cities might be living. So it's not visceral in the way that we can all relate to health and education. But I think when you talk to someone who's experienced poverty housing, you know, after food and water, it is the most basic need in terms of creating a decent life.
Yeah, we don't have very many mixed residential communities, that's for sure. You know, you mentioned before that you've helped over 13 million people since its founding. How many of them have been in the United States, and how many of them been in those other 70 or so countries?
I think people are often surprised because we have such a broad footprint in the U.S. with our 1,300 local Habitat chapters that the great majority of the families we serve are actually outside the U.S. Part of that, of course, is the cost per home is much lower, and part of that is the ability to do some market development work that has allowed us to scale faster in some countries around the world, and we can talk more about that. So if you looked at the current mix, historically probably it would be about 15 to 20% of our work domestic,
mm-hmm.
But currently it's approaching 95% of the individuals we're touching outside the U.S.
Yeah, that is surprising, I think, to a lot of people. What's the nature of the relationship that you have with these national offices and these affiliate organizations and the relationship they have with the international organization?
So we directly relate to them. They really own the local work. So if you're in the U.S. and you'd be working with your local Habitat, they're a local 501c3 nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And our role is to both equip and support them as well as uphold the standards and protect and grow the brand. So in some ways, it's not exactly a franchise, but almost works like that in the U.S. Internationally, we have a much bigger role in the direct funding and operations of some of the countries. But the same philosophy. We've always had a philosophy of it should be locally owned. You know, I loved meeting a new staff member in Indonesia who was very surprised to find that Habitat existed outside Indonesia. And, you know, that they viewed it as a local, their Indonesian nonprofit. And I think that's actually terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you cleared up one of the misconceptions I think a lot of people have before about the fact that you don't give away these homes. But let's get into a little bit more detail as to how this program works. How do you go about deciding what families will be eligible for it, and what are their responsibilities and obligations?
So we have a variety of programs, but the basic program would be there are three criteria to partner with Habitat. The first is we only work with low-income families. If the bank would give them a loan, we would typically not work with them. So we're serving families that are between usually 30 and 60% of the area median income.
Mm-hmm.
The second is the willingness to partner. And so we do treat them seriously. You know, they have to be ready to buy a home. So there's a whole preparation where they have to actually, in addition to sweat equity of helping build their home and their neighbors' homes, they have to take classes in financial management and home maintenance so that they're really well prepared by the time. And they also have to have clean credit and to demonstrate the ability to pay back that affordable mortgage. And so those are the three pieces. If they're low income, willing to partner, and demonstrate the ability to pay back that affordable mortgage, then we work with them. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, there's far more demand than we have land and resources to supply. So it is a competitive process, and it's always heartbreaking to turn families away. And then what's really exciting, though, is that amount of preparation has led to a remarkable success. If you think about it, we're technically a subprime lender.
Yep.
One of my favorite stories, with all the pain of the recession, when we had people across all income bands defaulting on their loans across the United States, Habitat's foreclosure rate went up to only 2%.
Wow.
So even though we're lending to very low-income families, that preparation, commitment, and in some ways, of course, the basics. We're lending them a mortgage they can actually afford on about 30% of their income, and then we're giving them the preparation and tools, and they're purchasing a very simple, energy-efficient home that they know how to take care of. And so it's in some ways the basics we think are there that maybe all housing organizations should follow.
Yeah. And looking at this issue from a broader perspective, let's talk about affordable housing. How many people in this country are paying more than 30%, whether it be for their mortgage or for their rent?
So shockingly, we have got I think is now 19 million households paying more than 30% of their income, and of that, close to half of them paying more than half of their income.
Oh my goodness.
On their rent or mortgage. And if you think about that, by definition, that means they're having to forego either costs for education, for medical, for food, for other constraints. And so it really does create a hardship. And even more, if you think about your true housing costs as the cost of your rent or mortgage plus your utility plus transportation to get to work, sort of the full cost of housing, it's actually much worse than that. Because often people are having to go far away to find affordable rents in our cities.
Yeah, families are having to make some horrific choices. Volunteers are the real backbone of your program, Jonathan. Tell us how you go about recruiting, managing, and then training people to build a house. Some who, like me, have no idea of what they're doing. And, of course, you're mindful of safety, their safety all the while.
Yeah, we take that last part incredibly seriously. So we have actually this amazing group of hardcore volunteers are called our caravanners who actually go around the country. They're self-sufficient, and they do trainings for all our affiliates on good safety practices. And we have safety certifications to make sure that we do create a safe environment. I think one of the ahas that we've had really is that the reason we use volunteers is less a construction strategy, though we're very excited to have our volunteers come out and build, but really it's part of the overall social change strategy. So what we're trying to do, what we really want is when you come out for that Habitat experience, and I had my first one when I was working for the Walt Disney Company more than 25 years ago, we want that to be an on-ramp to getting engaged in the issues of affordable housing, not an end in itself. And so our hope is that when people come out, they have this powerful experience, maybe working in a part of town they've never been in, maybe working with families in an economic strata that they're not used to, have not usually done. And what we see is mutual respect and learning coming out of that. And our hope is, out of that volunteer experience, they will become advocates and supporters of better housing policy, that they would become, we'd love them to become donors, and also break down the idea that the only way to volunteer is through construction. So we have wonderful skilled volunteers who are board members, who are mentors to the families, who are engaged in bringing their financial skills or legal skills or advocacy skills. So there are a huge number of ways that you can get involved that don't necessarily involve construction for those who don't want to put on a hard hat.
Yeah. Well, that's a very, very smart strategy, and I think getting them involved in the ecosystem is just the way to go. You know, another misconception that people have, which I don't think is quite as widespread, is that Habitat solely builds new homes. But you're very active in neighborhood revitalization as well, correct?
That's right. And we've always done a mix, but I would say, you know, if you can bring good out of bad, the huge housing crisis of 2008 and the recession accelerated the amount of work we were doing in terms of mix. So historically, we did majority whole houses and then a minority of rehabs and repairs. So we've always done some of both. I think the biggest mindset shift that we're really excited that actually brought our U.S. affiliates more in line with our global work was to not just think about how many houses can we build, but changing the framing question to what would it take to meaningfully reduce the housing deficit in each geography that we work. And that led to, along with the housing crisis, some really exciting movements by our affiliates to make long-term commitments to specific neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And now we've got over 300 affiliates who are doing this deep neighborhood revitalization where they've either started or joined coalitions that are really thinking holistically about addressing the needs of a community. And we're going to stay focused on housing, but we fully recognize that we also need people that are thinking about education and improving the schools, people thinking about livelihoods and jobs. You need the city to partner in terms of public safety. We need food. You need all the elements of a healthy community. And we've really seen some beautiful examples over time where we've seen transformation happen, but it does take a coalition approach, and that coalition approach actually needs to start with the community itself.
Yeah,
you really got to find the sometimes informal, sometimes formal leaders in the community, and get them to own the vision of what they want their community to become, and then think about what partners could come in and support that vision.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see you've moved to outcomes from outputs. You know,
yes.
Under your leadership, Habitat Disaster Risk and Reduction and Response Program has flourished. Now, I know that each disaster is different, but generally, how do you go about focusing your response in these difficult and trying circumstances?
Yeah, thanks, Denver. You know, part of when I first joined Habitat, you know, I had my carefully laid out 100-day plan, and then Hurricane Katrina hit right before I started, and that, of course, threw it all out the window.
Sure.
And the combination of that year was really a pivotal year for us because we had the, if you remember, the Indian Ocean tsunami had happened just that winter,
yep.
And then Katrina. So we had two of the largest global housing disasters in modern history happen that year. And those challenged us, rather than building a few houses in a lot of places, to think about how do we have a scale of impact in concentrated spaces. And that's when we formalized our disaster response program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really exciting. We helped over 25,000 families build back after the tsunami in Asia. And in across the Gulf Coast of the U.S., we ended up building over 5,000 homes and then and helping repair a large number more than that. And it was that was more, you know, a bigger concentrated effort than we had ever done before. And we learned a lot from that. It also allowed us to test and innovate some things that maybe wouldn't have been culturally okay in a non-disaster environment. But I think philosophically what we realized is that when these natural or man-made disasters happen, they're almost always housing disasters.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
So it was very much on mission. We're not a relief organization, but we recognize that we really should be part of the long-term rebuilding of these communities. And so it's become in any given year about 20% of our global work. And unfortunately, this past year was a really bad year
rough
for
one.
Disasters. We had the U.S. and Caribbean hurricanes. We had earthquakes in Mexico. We had terrible flooding in Asia. And then fires, and it just keeps on coming. Even if today we're praying for our friends in Hawaii that, that the hurricane will bypass or soften. So our strategy for our disaster response is the idea of a pathway to permanence. So we often will try to respond right away with volunteers in the cleanup phase. One thing we often do is distribute shelter kits that would allow a family to quickly put up temporary shelter or have the tools to do minor repairs on their own while early in the process that helps them stay close to their land and community. And then we want to come back and be part of the permanent rebuilding. And so we have a big initiative we're deep in the middle of called Habitat Hammers Back, which is our response to the three hurricanes that hit the U.S. and Puerto Rico last year and the Caribbean. But we've also got active disaster response going on in many places in the world right now.
Yeah, well, Habitat has a great reputation for being there for the long run. And we have, I think, what people refer to that CNN moment where everybody's there, everybody pays attention. But then the attention goes elsewhere, and that's when you guys really step up and really help the families over the long term when everybody else has moved on.
It's actually a great point for your listeners, Denver. Thank you. And I should have said, it's interesting, about 80% of the giving goes to that relief effort, meaning only 20% is there for the long-term rebuilding, which is terribly expensive. And so often we've encouraged people, yes, give to relief, but maybe think about splitting your funding and giving some to the relief, emergency relief, but then also investing in the long-term recovery because that's a huge challenge for these communities.
Yeah. Getting back to the Carters, this year marks the 35th Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Work Project, which is starting just about now. Where is it going to be for 2018?
So this year we'll be in St. Joseph County, Indiana.
Hmm.
And there's a nice backstory there, actually. There's a wonderful architect named Leroy Troyer who's become a dear friend. And Leroy has been the house builder on 32 of the 34 Carter projects. And so this is really to honor him. We're going to his hometown.
Oh, wow.
And building in St. Joseph County. So we will be in Mishawaka, Indiana, which is right by South Bend, where Leroy lives. And we're really excited. It's, you know, the Carters use this week every year to bring attention, not just to build homes, though it's impressive. They directly have worked alongside more than 100,000 volunteers in 14 countries and have either built, renovated, or repaired almost 4,300 homes. But the ripple effects are much greater than that. And we really use it as a way to bring new leadership into the mission, to bring awareness to the need for affordable housing, and really to put a spotlight on the work that we have ahead of us. And the Carters have been unbelievable ambassadors for our mission.
They certainly have. You know, an important source of your revenue, which helps support this work, is your over 1,000 Habitat for Humanity ReStores. What are those?
You know, our Habitat for Humanity restores are really a hidden gem, and we want to continue to bring more attention to them, so thank you for asking. The restores are essentially home product recycling stores, where if you were to move or remodel your house, we will take everything that could be put back into use by another family. So we would take the furniture, cabinets, appliances, toilets, doors, windows, mantels, frames, anything that could be taken and resold. We sell those products in the stores, which help both low-income families or remodelers, and then the proceeds help fund more houses for Habitat. So it's a really nice triple win.
Yeah.
Last year, it generated over $450 million in sales, and it kept a couple hundred thousand tons out of landfills. So it's an environmental win, and it's really a win for the community, as well as a way to leverage philanthropy. So when families give to Habitat, they're giving, and then the affiliate is both leveraging that giving with the mortgage payments from the families and the proceeds from the restores, and that really creates an opportunity. One thing that's important is these stores, of course, are open to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that both for low-income families in the community, it's a great source of low-cost products, but also for the sort of self-improvement people or the people in old houses that want to find that right doorknob or architectural window, they're a great treasure find as well. So I think it's been a wonderful story, and we hope to continue to grow it.
You know, one of your more successful initiatives has been in microfinance with the fund you created called MicroBuild. How does that work, and what has been its impact?
Thanks, Denver. We've actually become a global leader in housing microfinance. And if your listeners don't know, the microfinance industry has become very large around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea of non-bank institutions, but now banks have gotten into it, giving small business loans to very low-income families that historically wouldn't have been able to get banking or financing. But historically, these microfinance organizations wouldn't lend for housing. They would only lend for businesses. And we set out to demonstrate that actually there was a market for housing microfinance. So we started out by putting our own money into these microfinance groups and training them on how to do housing portfolios. After we had tested that in a number of countries,
mm-hmm.
we then launched, which was a big stretch for us, our first wholesale fund, where we took on debt and launched a $100 million fund called MicroBuild, where we are lending the money to these microfinance groups with technical assistance. They then lend it to their clients for home improvement loans. And the housing loans are actually outperforming on repayments to small business loans.
Hmm.
And the fund has already helped over 2 million people between our funds and the microfinance matching funds from their partners be able to do home improvements. Most of the funds are going to a very low-income family that might allow them to put a proper roof on their house for the first time or have a cement floor instead of a dirt floor or expand their house so that the girls and boys can be separated and they could run a small retail or
uh-huh.
business out of their expanded home or to get water or sanitation for the first time. So and we might actually then make multiple loans to that family over time, and our goal is to get them to the point where they would have a house that meets all the criteria for safeties and affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, you know, I've noticed that Habitat has been more engaged in recent years in advocacy efforts to remove some of the barriers to affordable housing, which we touched on a while ago, and that's both here in the United States and around the world. What are some of those efforts?
Thank you. You know, we realized that advocacy was a core principle, but we weren't doing enough about it. And our view is to really solve housing, we have to address housing policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you just a couple of examples that can make this real. One of my favorite stories actually is in Bolivia, where we have worked for decades. And in Bolivia, women didn't have the right to own property. And if you think about all the implications of that with divorce or abuse or inheritance,
yeah.
or lack of just being able to have an asset to access the financial markets. And so through the five-year effort from an amazing group of women that we trained in Bolivia, they not only were able to get their own rights to have title to their homes, they got the federal law changed. So if a man owned his home or land, wanted to register it, and was married, it had to be joint titled.
Mm-hmm.
So that immediately changed the enabling environment for 1.8 million women who suddenly could become homeowners. So we wouldn't count that in our first primary metrics until they actually got their titles. But that would be a shining example of improving the enabling environment that allows more people to invest in their housing. And a different example might be very local in the U.S., which would be changing a zoning law to allow more affordable housing to get built, or supporting, one of our big priorities is to have more mixed-income, mixed-use housing, because we think over time the data is really clear that actually that creates the best outcomes for everyone
yep.
in the community versus concentrated at poverty.
You know, Habitat has been blessed with a wonderful array of partners, corporate, media, faith, community partners, as well as some private philanthropists. Share with us what a few of those have done for the organization.
You know, it is, our work couldn't happen without partners, and that's really partners at the local, the state, the national, mm-hmm. and the global level. And it is remarkable the difference they've been able to make. In just a couple of examples, really powerful. We partner with an insurance company called Thrivent Financial, and Thrivent has invested now over $200 million in Habitat's mission. And really, with a joint strategy, their mission is to help people be more wise and generous, and it aligns really well with Habitat's mission. So that has touched in lots of ways, but they have come out and engaged in local communities, both in the U.S. and internationally, in a way that's been good for Habitat, but mm-hmm. interestingly good for them as well.
Yeah.
So they actually found that if their salespeople took their clients on international build trips with Habitat, that actually made them much more loyal to Thrivent, but also, of course, introduced them and gave them a very powerful transformational experience with Habitat. So we actually run 100 of those trips a year just with them to countries around the world with our Global Village program.
Just like
another example on an individual level, one of our great champions has been a man named Ron Terwilliger, who has invested deeply in supporting our advocacy program, and he actually did the initial underwriting to create our Terwilliger Center for Innovation in Shelter. And under that, we're doing our housing microfinance work. We have a shelter venture fund where we're investing in entrepreneurs that are coming up with better housing products for low-income families. And Ron has really been a strategic investor in building the capacity for us to help exponentially more people. And we, of course, still need houses funded and that direct work funded every year, but it's been very powerful where we've had strategic partners that have made long-term commitments.
Yeah, he's provided some like $100 million or so. It's been absolutely fantastic. Let me ask you about the organization itself and specifically the workplace culture. As the CEO, how do you think about the corporate culture of Habitat? And what things, Jonathan, do you do intentionally to help shape and influence that culture?
You know, I think culture is really about mindsets and behaviors. And the good news is, which wouldn't surprise you, the kind of people who are attracted to Habitat are unbelievably mission-minded.
Yeah.
So we are kind of off the charts in terms of the mission-driven side of it. But then how do you actually get them all to align and work together in our complex Habitat Federation? And so what we really focus on, it ties mostly around servant leadership capability.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, in the way that we serve, in the way that we collaborate, we really focus on a handful of kind of core values that we want to go deep on. Collaboration is built into everything we do. We really want to do everything through partnership because to do something as complex as housing takes the public sector, private sector, and civil society working together, much as I talked about neighborhood revitalization work. Obviously, you know, hiring the right people, one of our big challenges is, of course, we don't pay as well as some places.
Mm-hmm.
You can make more in the private sector. So we're looking for people that have that deep sense of mission commitment and really want to come and have impact and are looking for more of a total reward versus just financial reward in their mission. But because of the visibility and the strength of the brand, we've also been blessed by remarkably talented people who do want to come and be part of this infectious mission. We were thrilled last year and totally surprised to be recognized by Indeed.com
as the
best place to work and volunteer in America. And hopefully that reinforces, you know, if you can get great people, they will attract more great people, and then we can build a culture. But it's something that's always a work in process. I don't think you ever arrive.
No, absolutely. When you get happy with the status quo, you're going to go backwards. There's no question about it. You know, Habitat has been at this work now for over 40 years, and I'm sure you're always tweaking the model to make it more effective and more meaningful and better. What are some of your current challenges and things you're looking to improve upon?
You know, I think the first challenge actually goes back to where we started the conversation, is can we get housing higher on the public agenda?
Mm-hmm.
I think in the U.S. it's interesting. It's actually gotten so bad. We have a big enough crisis now that the Council of Mayors, for the first time that I'm aware, said affordable housing was the number one issue in our country, which means at least finally maybe there may be more room. So I would say first is that challenge of making the connection of why housing should be a high priority for people's time, energy, and investment. I think the second is even people who are generically supportive of housing often get less supportive when it's in their community. So mm-hmm. how do we actually educate people? And it's why our volunteer programs actually are so important, because it starts to create empathy and understanding and relationship. So it's not those people. It becomes individual people who have the same hopes, dreams, and aspirations. So we need to break down those barriers in a way that is more welcoming to building mixed-income communities, because the inequality data is quite clear that children who grow up in concentrated poverty have very little social mobility, which turns out to be bad for everyone, whereas low-income children who grow up in mixed-income communities actually have very high social mobility because they're given the chance. And I think Habitat is all about that hand up, not a handout, or creating that opportunity. But how do we broaden that conversation to reach more people, and how do we do that? So we're going to – that goes to more advocacy, but it continues to be a challenge. I would say in terms of constraint, like most nonprofits, and you could – it's a sort of chicken and egg – we always need more money, and we always need stronger leadership. And if you have more money, it's easier to get more leaders. If you have great leaders, they can get more money. But we're always trying to build better and deeper leadership at all of the places that we work, and continuing to attract really high capacity leaders in a very competitive workspace, is an ongoing challenge for us.
Yeah, that too will always be a work in progress. Let me close with this, Jonathan. Habitat is a self-described Christian housing ministry, and after stints on Wall Street and with several major corporations, you were the executive pastor of a church when the call came about this job. What is the role of faith in the work of Habitat for Humanity, and how does it inform your leadership of the organization?
You know, I think faith has always been central to Habitat's work in terms of the motivation. So if you look at our mission statement, the first part of the mission statement is about God's love in action. We're not a church or a religious organization. We're a service organization. But the motivation behind that is really to be a demonstration of God's love to all God's people, regardless of their background or their personal beliefs. The center of our mission statement is that we bring people together. And I think one of the beautiful things that pulled me to Habitat is the way that it does actually break down barriers. We were joking before, but around the world, the first Habitat in Africa was built in a no-man's land between warring tribes. And we've been pioneers, whether it's in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, South Africa between blacks and whites, Egypt between Christians and Muslims. We've been all about actually lowering barriers. One of my heroes, Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Tutu, sponsored a build every year for many years in South Africa with us. And he said, as the physical walls of the home go up, the invisible walls that separate us as people come tumbling down, and hope is built in the community. And I think, to me, that's such a beautiful picture of what faith in action should look like in our increasingly polarized world. And so one of the informal phrases we use internally is God is our center but not our border, that we are motivated by our faith but joyfully welcome everyone and want to live in that tension of being radically inclusive and not giving up that central motivation. But we recognize that we have many Habitat supporters for whom that's not their primary motivation, but that's Habitat's organizational motivation.
Mm-hmm. Well, well stated. Well, Jonathan Reckford, the CEO of Habitat for Humanity International, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. How does someone become involved as a volunteer, maybe to contribute, maybe to find where some of these restores are?
Well, we would love it. The simplest way is just go to habitat.org, and you can, there's a whole section on get involved, and you can quickly do a search and find your local Habitat organization. You can find your local restore, and you can find ways to get involved and volunteer. And I would just say, please come join us. I can't tell you how many volunteers have come up and thanked me for the opportunity to come out and really experience the kind of community that we all want to be a part of but too rarely feel. And I think that's been the secret sauce that has made Habitat an enduring mission.
Well, let me thank you, Jonathan. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.